Well, it's been over 3 years since we've been broadcasting your weekly constitutional, and recently I was checking our iTunes page, and I noticed, to my surprise, that we had over 150 episodes up as podcasts, and I noticed also that iTunes gives me a handy guide to show me which are the most popular episodes, and I was somewhat amused to notice that we've done two particular episodes that you seem to be interested in more than any others. Number one was on medical marijuana, and number two was on recreational marijuana. Do you notice a pattern there? Yes, it is. Not just from a social perspective, but from a constitutional perspective, it's an absolutely fascinating topic. So I'm going to give you another one. Here's your third episode, and this one we'll simply call Marijuana Update. It's your weekly constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and it's all about the wacky weed.
This is your weekly constitutional, underwritten by James Madison's Montpelier. Your host is Stuart Harris, who teaches constitutional law at the Appalachian School of Law in Grundy, Virginia.
I sometimes tell my law students that among all the constitutional issues we discuss in class, gay marriage and same-sex marriage, if you prefer, is perhaps one of the most striking because of all the shifting in the constitutional landscape that's gone on over the past 20 years and especially over just the last few years. But there's one other issue out there that is just as striking and is just as constitutional in its own way, and that is the continuing change in the laws of various states and even the federal government, perhaps here soon, over the legalization or at least the decriminalization of marijuana. Now, how is that constitutional, you ask? Well, there's a huge, huge issue there. When a state decides it's going to decriminalize marijuana, when a state decides even that it's not going to enforce marijuana laws, then you've got a disconnection. You've got the state law saying one thing, and you've got federal law, which still criminalizes, in fact, in a very serious way, still criminalizes the mere possession of the green medicine, as one of our guests will call it. Not too long ago, in the second of those two episodes I mentioned to you, the one on recreational marijuana, I spoke to Rob Mikos, and he is a professor at Vanderbilt University, and he specializes in a constitutional concept called federalism, that is, the relationship between state law on the one side and federal law on the other side. And I asked him specifically how these legalization movements for marijuana implicate that concept.
Well, because there's such a stark contrast between the content of state and federal policy. The federal government has taken a no-prisoners approach to this issue. It has banned the drug marijuana outright, making, practically speaking, no exception for the legal use or cultivation of the drug. Recently, just about 17 years ago, starting in California, you had some states that started to take a different approach. Historically, at least since the 1930s, all of the states had taken a similar approach to the federal government. They had banned marijuana outright. But in the mid-1990s, starting with California, you had a few states that started to recognize that this drug might have some medicinal benefits.
Mm-hmm.
And so they started to legalize it, at least in this narrow context. They were saying, if you use this pursuant to the recommendation of a physician, if you suffered from a list of medical conditions approved by the state, you could go ahead and use this drug legally under state law without running afoul of federal law or being penalized under state law. So there's a stark contrast between that state approach, which allows marijuana for some purposes, and the federal approach, which says marijuana is never legal outside of very, very narrow research context.
Well, what's confusing about this for a lot of people, and thank you for that explanation because that's very helpful, but what's confusing for a lot of people, especially people who've heard of the supremacy clause, is the idea that, you've got a conflict between the feds on the one side and the states on the other. So doesn't that mean, first of all, is there a conflict? Does this create an actual conflict between state and federal law?
Well, it's harder to imagine a starker conflict than this, a state allowing something that the federal government expressly forbids. So you have a conflict here, but it's important to note that there's a limit to federal supremacy. And so there's a little bit more nuance to this conflict than that.
Thanks to Rob Mikos of Vanderbilt University Law School for explaining that issue so clearly. Another fellow that I've spoken to several times now is now going to be our guest for the remainder of the show. His name is Howard Wooldridge. He is an activist on behalf of legalization of marijuana. He is very active in a group called LEAP, or Law Enforcement Against Prohibition of Pot, that is. And recently I called up Howard and I said, Howard, I just need an update because you guys have been going gangbusters, and I think you'll enjoy his report.
Yeah, my name is Howard Wooldridge. Currently, I serve as the voice of law enforcement in the United States Congress as a lobbyist and advocate. My background is a graduate of Michigan State University, a degree in education, 18 years of police officer in the mid-Michigan area, moved to Texas, learned how to ride a horse. In 2003, rode my horse from Georgia to Oregon, and in 2005, rode the horse from LA to New York City, kind of a Paul Revere ride on steroids, keeping to the drug theme, to alert Americans to the failure of policy to wit the war on drugs, modern prohibition, whatever you want to call it, and then came down to Washington, D.C. in the fall of 2005 to be the voice of LEAP, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. This is a 50,000-member organization now with members in 75 countries, I believe. Basically, their macro point of view is prohibition is a horrific failure and increases crime, death, disease, and probably drug use. And in the Congress for the last 9 years now, I've advocated a 10th Amendment position, states' rights, on the issue of drugs. And that's what I do on a daily basis now here in the Washington, D.C. area.
Howard, I just don't know where to begin. There are just so many fascinating facts there.
My bucket list is pretty small, actually.
I absolutely believe that, but I'm going to start with something that's sort of on a personal level. You mentioned Michigan State. I'm from a Michigan State family, and you also mentioned mid-Michigan. Where about Michigan were you a cop?
Well, right there in the East Lansing area where Michigan State's located.
So let me get this straight then. You spent 4 years at State probably drinking a lot of beer, and then you turned around and started busting your old frat buddies. Is that it?
Well, let's say I took 7 years to get a four-year degree at the end of the draft, and I enjoyed college, so I kind of stretched it out a little bit. And I smoked a lot more marijuana than I drank beer, although I did do both. I gave up marijuana 2 weeks before I went to the police academy, not because they drug tested, but because I thought, well, okay, it's time to grow up. Almost everyone going to the police academy in the 1970s, probably about 90% of the guys and women had used marijuana, had experience with it. So they didn't ask the question. They didn't drug test or anything back then.
It's funny you should say that. I have a friend in law enforcement. He actually works for the FBI, and he once told me that they used to reject people who had smoked marijuana, or at least who had admitted it, until they had no applicants left.
Correct. Yeah, I saw that about 4 years ago. You can now, I believe, smoke 50 times in your life and still become an FBI agent. And exactly right. In fact, one of the generals or someone got in real hot water here, maybe the head of Homeland Security, when he testified before the Congress that he just could not find enough qualified computer operators to wear the white hat because they're probably smoking marijuana on the way to the interview. And a couple senators took umbrage, but it's certainly indicative that in today's world, if you cut out a whole class of people who smoke marijuana, you lose a lot from the pool, as now we've got over 100 million Americans have tried marijuana at least once. And as your audience probably knows, the last three presidents.
That, yes, indeed. Well, you know, reality intrudes. You have preconceived notions, you have ideas, somewhat arbitrary qualifications, and then all of a sudden reality intrudes. So that's interesting. That means that somebody like me, who doesn't look nearly as much like a cowboy as you do, I could nonetheless start in Michigan as I did, go to Texas, get a horse, get a hat, and, you know, be a legitimate cowboy. Is that it?
Well, yeah. You know, before I called myself a cowboy, I checked with guys who really were cowboys, who used a horse to work cattle. And they said, you rode your horse across America. The horse, only one horse, by the way, it makes a difference. Any fool can ride 10 across America and hurt them. But they said, you rode one horse across America, 3,100 miles. you can call yourself a cowboy. So I've taken them at their word, and that's why my business card says Howard Cowboy Wooldridge.
So it's more than just moving to Texas and buying a hat. Okay. Well, Howard, obviously all this is fascinating, but what is really most fascinating about you is, of course, that you are a law enforcement or ex-law enforcement person who has not only acknowledged the situation, but has, embraced the situation, and you've become quite an activist when it comes to the abolition of drug prohibition. Could you tell me about your own journey? I mean, how did you come to this conclusion? Why did you decide to make this your cause?
Well, after I retired, I was looking for something meaningful to do. I had a good job in international service, speaking my four languages. However, that provided a paycheck but didn't fill up my soul. I wanted to do something important, and I grabbed onto the war on drugs because it entails so much pain, suffering, and death, not just in the United States, but also across the world. It affects foreign relations. It affects foreign governments. It affects a whole lot of things. Terrorists are well-funded with drug money. Drug policy is the place to go. As far as an epiphany, I had one. I mean, I always knew this chasing a green plant and Willie Nelson and his friends was a horrible waste of good police time. But I really had the epiphany on all drugs as a detective doing follow-up on a burglary. I asked the homeowner, the guy, I said, so could you describe the pocket watch that was stolen? He says, well, it belonged to my grandfather. It had silver this, and you know, he described it. And I said, well, could you give me the approximate value? And the guy slammed his fist into the dresser, yelling, it was priceless. It was my grandfather's pocket watch. No amount of money can bring that back. And his wife started to cry. And it was a huge moment where I said, because when I was arresting people for breaking into your house, about 80% of them were crackheads who needed $200 a day. And my thought at the time was, why don't we let the crackheads have all they want until they're dead? Stop bothering good people in my city. And from that point, it was the thought that if you have a drug problem, see a doctor, or if you don't decide to see a doctor, shake hands with Whitney Houston and Elvis Presley and all those who have gone before who abused drugs to the point of death. Leave good people alone. And that's where I got started. That was 1994. I became active in the drug reform in 1997. And I've been there ever since.
It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and we're doing our third, count them, three episodes, the third of three episodes so far on the legalization of marijuana and its constitutional implications. Today, we're speaking with Howard Wooldridge, getting an update from the front. After the break, we'll continue our fascinating discussion with Cowboy Howard Wooldridge. Stay tuned.
Legalize it, yeah, yeah, and I will advertise it.
Tonight's question is, have you ever smoked pot? And so this is a way that we judge a book, indeed, by its cover. Are you ready to play? Let's meet our first pedestrian.
My name is Shedrick. I'm from Atlanta, Georgia.
Have you ever smoked pot?
Has Shedrick ever smoked pot? Well, let's find out.
I don't know if I can answer that question.
You already did.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with Howard Cowboy Wooldridge, a member of LEAP, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. Prohibition of marijuana. Now, before the break, Howard was telling me why he got into this racket, no pun intended, and why he is committed to the legalization of this particular medicine.
Okay, Howard, it sounds then to me very similar to something I heard some years ago from, I believe it was the mayor of Baltimore. He said, if you see the kid next door using drugs, you call the cops. But when it's your kid, you're going to call the doctor. It sounds to me like that's consistent with the epiphany that you had.
Yeah, pretty much. And along the line of current events, about a year ago, the governor of Missouri had a son in college who was busted for marijuana, made the news, of course. And he said, look, you guys in the media and everybody else, just butt out. This is a family matter and we'll handle it inside the family. And of course, that's what every parent will do, or almost every parent will do. But you're absolutely correct. If it's somebody else's kid, they should be busted, given a criminal record, go to jail for a week or two or a month or two, because they are criminals and need to be punished. This has been consistent over 40 years of drug war, where the scenario you talked about, yeah, my kid goes to treatment, your kid goes to jail. That's the best way to handle it.
And in much the same fashion, I guess. I mean, I'm not meaning to make your arguments for you. I'm simply thinking out loud here. That's kind of, you can generalize too, the international problem that you alluded to. We want one set of standards for ourselves, but then we want to impose a lot of the costs of that on other people in ways that harm them. Is that also part of your argument?
Oh, certainly. I was in Costa Rica 3 weeks ago for an all Latin American conference, and it was well understood by the 400 people who participated that the North Americans are the ones who will send money south to Plan Colombia, Plan Mexico, Plan whatever, but it is the people on the ground in Mexico, Guatemala, Colombia, etc., who are paying the price in blood in terms of our drug prohibition. They understand it quite well, and there's now a loud voice in Central America and beyond saying we need to re-examine this, because as much as America has to pay for it, North America is paying the bill in money, they're paying for it in blood and violence, corruption, rape, as the gangs take over, etc. The good news is a lot of folks now are unhappy with the status quo.
Yeah, and we'll get to that. In fact, that's actually why I called you again today. I've had you on, I think, twice before, and you're kind enough to send me your email newsletter, and I have been sort of stunned at your successes of late. But before we leave this part of it, and again, I'm just thinking out loud here, we in the United States, certainly we legalize and we even promote our own tobacco farmers. We subsidize them, and I'm sure they export some things overseas. And it's very clear that tobacco is not only contains a drug, nicotine, a very powerful drug, but consuming tobacco is extremely harmful for you. And of course, we do that with our own farmers. But I guess what we're effectively telling other countries is, you know, you've got people who typically have a much lower standard of living to begin with, who are trying to feed their families by growing a different plant that's a drug and exporting it to us, and put those people in jail.
Oh yeah, the hypocrisy is off the charts. Story from 20 years ago, the country of Colombia tried hard to do away with advertising, billboards, etc., American cigarettes. And the American tobacco industry fought back tooth and nail and was successful at having the U.S. government pressure the Colombians not to ban advertising for the American deadly tobacco cigarette. This is well known. This is all about ugly politics and ugly Americans and just raw power of the money and who controls the world. And it's shameful, and I'm embarrassed.
Well, these arguments have been around a long time, and those of us who have been paying attention have heard most of them. But again, what strikes me is how you seem to have finally gotten to the point where you're building momentum and people are starting to agree with you. So let's go back just a few years now and tell me, when do you feel that you actually started having success after beating your head against the wall for a few years?
I have always given credit to Ron Paul, who in 2007 he started running for president, and he influenced millions and millions of young people to start leaning libertarian, to start leaning less government intrusion in your personal life, or less federal power, more state power. And in Congress, where I spend my time, in the sandbox I play in, Republican aides, when I first got here in 2005, were overwhelmingly conservative. And they did not like the libertarian position. Ron Paul came in, and Stewart, it was amazing. Within a space of 24 months, almost every legislative aide in the Republican Congress had been converted into a little Ron Paul libertarian. I was coming through the door, and they say, look, I'm all in favor of what Ron Paul promotes, and what can I do for you? And, oh, by the way, let me tell you how to sell this better to Republican offices. I had legislative aides telling me how to do my job, which was wonderful because, yeah, how do you navigate the labyrinth corridors of power in Congress and be effective? And there's no better source than talking to a legislative aide. So this is the type of massive zeitgeist change we had in 2007 to 2008 and 2009. And since then, my job has been much less difficult to get the members of Congress to change their position because I have a small arm. We have a small army now of Republican aides who are, let's say, trying to convince their bosses that the best position for a conservative Republican, etc., is to employ the 10th Amendment. And this bore fruit in the spring of 14, when for the first time ever in history, the House voted 231 to about 192 to say states' rights for medical marijuana in the now 31 states that have some type of medical marijuana. This was absolute historic vote. I had like 51 Republicans vote my way, and we won. And the good news is once a member of Congress decides to embrace the 10th Amendment, they rarely backslide. So this has been a watershed year in terms of the vote, but the process got started in 07-08, and I give essentially 100% of the credit to Ron Paul, the former congressman from Texas.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe that both Ron Paul and his son Rand, who of course is now a U.S. senator from Kentucky, I believe they're both physicians, aren't they?
That's correct. Senator Paul is an ophthalmologist, and Ron Paul, I believe, was a OBGYN.
Yeah, and of course, again, that's not something that you would necessarily expect, either to have a cop in your position or to have a doctor in their position. I'm wondering if their own medical practices, and maybe even especially Rand Paul's, given that marijuana is considered one treatment for glaucoma, I wondered, have you happened to speak to them? Was that part of their reasoning, is that they saw that there might be medical uses for this, or at least there was conversely nothing to fear from it?
Well, I have spoken to both, but not more than just the usual 30-second meet and greet. So the short answer is I don't know. The good news is that by anecdotal information, many, many tens of thousands of doctors in this country have heard stories from their patients about the positive impact of God's medicine on their health, whether from their eyes to whatever. And so they probably have heard through their professional organizations about this. But specifically, I don't think either one has spoken out that they have had a personal epiphany or knowledge and belief of what can the green plant do for Americans.
Okay, so this is really just more about libertarianism asserting itself within the Republican Party. Did I understand you correctly?
Absolutely. In fact, as another example, 3 weeks ago, Senator Roberts, 70-odd years old, three, four terms in the Senate, going for re-election, was asked by a reporter, what would you do about Colorado? And he said, I think marijuana should be a state's rights issue. I think Colorado should be allowed to sell it and tax it. That should be a matter for Colorado to decide. So that's the type of feeling which is sweeping the nation. Essentially, Stuart, marijuana is about 2-3 years behind the same changes we saw with gay rights.
That has been extraordinary too, hasn't it?
Sure, sure. And that's part of that libertarian, my understanding, and I've read some material on it, young people, that's anybody under 40, is now strongly leaning libertarian on a number of issues. Number one, gay rights, and number two, marijuana use, saying it's none of the government's business what I do when I close the door to my little castle. You know, the wind may blow in and the rain may leak through the roof, but the king and his agent should stay outside the door.
Very interesting. Well, trace a little bit for us the victories you've had. You say things started to change in 07. How did the dominoes start to fall? It was medical marijuana to begin with, wasn't it?
That's correct. MPP, Marijuana Policy Project, the largest group, largest lobbying force in Washington, D.C. for marijuana, had always had a bill to apply states' rights to a 10th Amendment to medical marijuana. And then 5 years ago, I'd been on the Hill a couple of years and basically learning the ropes and learning the players. And I was not happy with the bill from neither MPP nor Normal. Normal always introduced a bill to decrim 3.5 ounces. And these bills would get 5 or 10 co-sponsors, but they were, of course, not where we wanted to go in the end. We wanted to go to ending federal prohibition. So I called for a Whiskey Friday about 5 years ago now and said, look, in the next session, we should ask for, in terms of having a member write the bill, what we want in the end, and that is an end to federal prohibition of the green plant. And I brought half a gallon of Crown Royal whiskey, and I was pouring the glasses. Anytime they got halfway empty, I'd pour some more in. And about 8 of us, leaders in the D.C. area on this issue, and at the end of the 2 hours, we took a vote, and it was decided unanimously that in the next session, we would go for a full repeal of marijuana bill. And in fact, then Ron Paul and Barney Frank, the former congressman from Massachusetts, did write up the bill, which was the first ever, and now we're working in that bill to eventually get it passed.
You've mentioned several names and several organizations like Barney Frank and like Normal, which are typically identified with not libertarian so much, but liberal. It sounds to me like that you're reaching across the aisle here then, and that you're finding a commonality of interest.
Oh, absolutely. This issue cuts all boundaries of politics. You have liberals like Barney Frank, and they're if I may speak for the liberal wing, they see the injustice. They see this as the most immoral policy since slavery and Jim Crow. Orange is the New Black, the book by Michelle Alexander, The New Jim Crow is the Drug War, etc. And so for those good, solid liberal reasons, they want to end this drug prohibition. And then conservatives, more libertarians, are saying this is not where the government should go and spend its resources, its time. This is a matter of personal liberty. This is a matter of limited government, both at the federal and state level. And going into a citizen's home because they're putting marijuana in their body as opposed to nicotine or alcohol or oxycodone just makes no sense to more and more Republicans. So we have this wonderful coalition, if you will, or at least a convergence of far left to far right saying for different reasons we should end the policy. Grover Norquist, whom if you're a liberal, you pretty much hate him, he is 100% on our side, has said so publicly.
That is remarkable. In fact, it seems to be one of the relatively few areas of bipartisanship in the last few years.
Indeed.
Howard, could you expand a little bit? I've heard you say this once or twice, that drug prohibition is the new Jim Crow. What do you mean by that?
As your audience knows, at the end of the Civil War, the South instituted a number of laws that essentially almost put the black man and black woman back into the plantation-type mentality. And for 100 years, that was what was keeping them suppressed. In the 60s, you had your civil rights laws passing in 64, 65, 66, 68. And so by the 1970, on paper anyway, the African American was ready to become a regular citizen, a normal citizen inside of our society. And then a year later, Nixon launched the war on drugs. Reagan really took off on it. And then you had basically where black men had come out of chains and slavery and crop sharing and whatever else, all of a sudden they're back in prison, they're back in chains, they're making 40 cents an hour, they get out of prison, they can't vote, which you know the Civil Rights Act of 66 should have taken care of, and all the vestiges of slavery came back into existence due to the drug war.
That really is remarkable that you should draw that parallel, and it's a fairly compelling argument, but you're referencing some history here that I think we need to emphasize. You're right. I mean, slavery was abolished in 1865, and then there were several other post-Civil War amendments that, you know, like the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment and the voting,
sure.
All those things right after the Civil War. And in response to that, once Reconstruction ended, I think about 1877, when it ended, the many southern states and other states, it wasn't just the South, enacted what were then called Black Codes. And that was the actual title that they would give to the laws that then came to be known as Jim Crow. And people generally know about that. But what they don't realize is that on the slimmest of pretexts, some local sheriff would go out and simply round up young black men and accuse them of some insignificant crime, or maybe more significant, but one way or the other, they'd be in front of all white juries and white judges, and they would be put in jail. And the next thing you know, they'd be out working in a field. But instead of calling them slaves, they were on a chain gang. And I think there's been more and more attention to that, and more scholarship directed toward that slavery substitution, or that informal way, or that way of reviving the institution. In just the past few years, I've seen that. And I guess what I'm understanding now is that you're saying that once the chain gangs were more or less abolished, that then came drug prohibition. And that is now something that allows the police, whether intentionally or not, to arrest young black men for a relatively insignificant crime. But now, as you say, now he's got a criminal record. Now it's harder to get a job. Now the chance of recidivism goes up. And all of a sudden, these people have entered the prison pipeline, and we've effectively got the same thing going on. Is that your argument?
Iqbal Alexander wrote the book about 2-3 years ago, outlining in great detail exactly what you just said. One third of the black men in Florida cannot vote because of a minor arrest. I mean, minor in terms of importance, for simple possession of a hard drug like cocaine, 1 gram, which is like a packet of equal, is a felony both in Florida and Texas. And in Florida, those black men have lost their right to vote forever. And this, of course, changed the presidential election in 2000. I mean, Gore would have absolutely won, but tens of thousands of black men were not allowed to vote because of this Jim Crow-type punishment for simple possession of cocaine. You know, if Charlie Sheen gets arrested in California for a couple grams, he's not going to lose his right to vote for very long. He'll get it back. But across the South, this has been used for voter suppression, which is something that, you know, everyone's addressing these days, but they're addressing it through the laws passed by Republicans when they are. I was at a Congressional Black Caucus annual blowout they have in September, and the panel was talking about all these new laws coming in Pennsylvania and everywhere else to deny minorities the vote. And I said, ladies and gentlemen, you're forgetting about the greatest vote suppression set of laws in America, the war on drugs. And I mentioned Florida, and they all kind of went, oh, yeah, we kind of forgot about that. I was like, I mean, I'm a white guy, and, you know, in a room with 1,000 black people, I'm going, y'all need to get your priorities straight that, yeah, I go after these new laws in Pennsylvania, but you need to end the war on drugs, because it's the greatest single cause of you guys not voting, and they're doing what they do. But, yeah, this has been, again, it's shameful and immoral. I lived in the South in the late 60s when I went to a segregated school for a number of years. And I used to see chain gangs when I was delivering my papers. So in my lifetime, I've seen the change, but the chain gangs are no longer so much on the side of the roads. They're working in a prison industry for 35 cents an hour.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm getting a report from the front of the front on the war to decriminalize marijuana from Howard Cowboy Wooldridge, who is a member of LEAP, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. After the break, we'll have our Madison Minute, and then we'll continue. In fact, we'll conclude our discussion with Howard Wooldridge, which I think you agree with me is just fascinating.
The very next day, we picked a bunch of them weeds, and we put them in the sun to dry. And we mashed them up and cleaned them off, put them in the corn cob pie. Smoking them wildwood flowers got to be a habit. We never seen no harm. Oh, we thought it was kind of handy. Take a trip and never leave the farm. They go puff that wildwood weed. Next thing you know, you're just wandering around behind the little animals.
The burning of Washington in 1814 was an attack during the War of 1812 between British forces and those of the United States. On August 24, 1814, after defeating the Americans at the Battle of Bladensburg, a British force led by Major General Robert Ross occupied Washington City and set fire to many public buildings, including the White House and the Capitol, as well as other facilities of the U.S. government. Throughout the history of the United States, the United Kingdom is the only country to have ever burned the White House or Washington, D.C. President James Madison and members of the military and his government fled the city in the wake of the British attack. They eventually found refuge for the night in Brookville, a small town in Montgomery County, Maryland, which is known today as the United States Capitol for a day. With a Madison Minute, I'm Jim Blaylock.
Yeah, man, that song's about that.
About aliens.
Yeah, man, you didn't know that? This country is founded. It was founded by people who were into aliens, man. George Washington, man, he was in a cult. And the cult was into aliens, man. You didn't know that?
No.
Oh, man, they were way into that type of stuff, man.
George Tote Weed. Man.
Absolutely George Tote Weed. Are you kidding me, man? He grew fields of that stuff, yeah, man. That's what I'm talking about. Fields.
He grew that shit up in Mount Vernon, man.
Mount Vernon, man. He grew it all over the country, man. He had people growing it all over the country, you know? The whole country back then was getting hot. Let me tell you, man, because he knew. He was onto something, man. He knew that it would be a good cash crop for the southern states, man. And so he grew fields of it, man. But you know what? Behind every good man, there's a woman. And that woman was Martha Washington, man. And every day George would come home, she'd have a big fat bowl waiting for him, man, when he'd come in the door, man. She was a hip lady, man. And she was real cool too. She'd harvest the crops, man. That's what I'm talking about. She'd put in the bushels and stuff and sell it, you know, because they had to, you know, make ends meet and stuff. I mean, did you ever look at a dollar bill, man? There's some spooky stuff going on a dollar bill, man.
Yeah.
I mean, and it's green, too.
It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and now it's just about time to finish up my discussion with Howard Wooldridge, who opposes the prohibition of marijuana. Before we get to that, though, let me just say that I realize that this is all kind of from Howard's perspective today, and I'd be very pleased to hear from somebody on the other side of the issue, someone, that is, who favors the continued criminalization of marijuana. In the past, I haven't been able to find anybody on that side of the issue who's been willing to come on the show. It seems to be a position without at least any vocal advocates at the moment, but I'd love to hear from you. My email address here is ywc@montpelier.org. Once again, ywc@montpelier.org. Please let us hear from you. Before the break, I was speaking with Howard about his position on drug prohibition as being a continuation of Jim Crow. Now, that might strike you odd. It struck me as sort of odd the first time he mentioned it to me. But he's got some pretty interesting arguments on his side.
You've mentioned cocaine, and I think the example that I often hear about the use of the drug laws to disproportionately affect young black men is the differential treatment of powder cocaine and crack cocaine. Could you discuss that a little bit?
Sure. Well, when the crack cocaine became a phenomenon in the U.S. in the mid-80s, it was thought of as being so much worse than cocaine, and we're going to have when women were pregnant using it, it was going to make these kids, you know, be born with a 50 IQ forever, the crack babies, so-called, etc. So there was a hysteria, and I was a police officer at the time, I was in uniform, there was a hysteria sweeping the people, the media, everybody's going a little loco about crack cocaine, and based on no science, no research, the Congress, and with the Democrats, by the way, leading the charge, and in fact, black Democrats were in front of the white Democrats saying, we need to really crack down on this new crack cocaine, punish it heavily so nobody would use it. There were even calls for a 1,000-to-1 ratio by some black congressmen in the mid-80s during debate. They compromised. They compromised at 100-to-1 punishment, crack versus powder cocaine. And what we now know due to research, and I've seen testimony by our top doctors in the U.S. government, when a molecule of cocaine hits your brain, whether in the form of crack or powder, there is 0.0 difference on the impact on your brain. And so all these laws were based on no science, just hysteria. This had to do with Len Bias, the basketball player dying, and some other stuff. But at the end of the day, the Congress acted rashly, and it wasn't fixed until 2010, when some Republicans in the Senate grudgingly reduced it to 18-1. Not based on science, again, just they just couldn't bring themselves to believe it should go from 100-1 to 1-1.
So was it really more of a matter of hysteria, or was there some actual intent to use this differential in a manner to oppress young black people?
I would say that if I had to bet a dollar, there was some overt racism in the back of their brains saying, we just can't let, you know, these darkies out there, you know, running around doing crack cocaine, because it's going to cause problems. Although there was no science, no research, they just had a feeling. And that's just, it was a couple of Republicans from the South that were the ones that say, we'll grudgingly bring it down to 18-1. There's no question in my mind there's racism here in it, but I have no smoking gun.
Understood. You've mentioned cocaine, and we talked about it. Do you feel the same way about prohibition of other drugs as you do about the prohibition of marijuana? I mean, some of the same arguments to decriminalize these other drugs, of course, would apply to marijuana. Mm-hmm. How do you feel about that?
Let me be clear. The reason I get up and go to work in the morning in my retirement age is teenagers and young people. First and foremost, every child in America from roughly the ages of 12 to 25 has a job option to sell illegal drugs. Every day, 8, 9, 10 are shot and shot dead. According to the U.S. government, we have almost a million teenagers today employed as drug dealers. This is shameful, this is immoral, and this is preventable. They're not selling alcohol, they're not selling tobacco, They're selling what they can make a lot of money at without breaking a sweat, and that's illegal drugs. The other half of that coin is, talking to current law enforcement, we are absolutely missing pedophiles, people possessing and making child cyber pornography, teen sex trafficking, slavery, if you will, is back in our larger cities all over the place. Recently, the federal prosecutor in Philadelphia said arresting another group for teen sex slavery is like shooting fish in a barrel, quote unquote. This is horrific. As a police officer, as a detective, I arrested people hurting our little boys and girls, and to know that we're missing them because we're chasing Charlie Sheen and his supplier gets me up in the morning, gets me on the train, and talks to people in Congress, Stuart. This is what makes the cowboy run.
Understood. So does that mean that, generally speaking, once it looks like you're well on your way to achieving your goal with marijuana, will there be other drugs that you would seek to have decriminalized? Go ahead, please.
I say, absolutely. Look, the only way I know of it, and I am open to new ideas. I've always been I think they call it the classic liberal mindset. Somebody explain to me how they're going to get rid of the job option for those million teens to sell drugs, and I'll be happy to listen. But I don't know how you get rid of that job option inside the framework of prohibition. And yes, at the end of the day, I would say we should legalize, regulate, and tax all these drugs. And then if you have a drug problem, see a doctor. Or as I said earlier, if you don't decide to see a doctor, like people don't do with alcohol and tobacco and prescription drugs, you will be shaking hands with Whitney Houston, and that's on you, the adult.
Understood. Okay, let's shift to the states now. You've been pounding the pavement up in Washington, D.C. for years and years and walking the halls of Congress, and that's where some of your recent progress has come. But, of course, the casual observer like me is just stunned by how one after the other these states are coming over to your side. Now, let's go back to that. What was the first state that actually moved toward decriminalization or legalization of marijuana?
Well, in the 70s, you had about 9 states decriminalize the possession of marijuana up to usually about an ounce. Even, I think it's Mississippi, if you are arrested for 1 ounce or less, excuse me, if you're caught with 1 ounce or less, you don't go to jail. There's no jail time attached to it. Ohio's another one. There was about 9 states that did that.
Wow, that must have been in the 70s. And those and Mississippi and Ohio are not noted as hotbeds of liberalism.
No, they're not. But there was I lived through that period. I was a police officer. And what it was, people at the state level recognized that marijuana was less harmful than alcohol, so the penalties should be reduced, and they did it. But then, long story short, that ended in the late 70s. There were people concerned that teenagers, 13-year-olds were smoking it and causing them to become amotivational. And so it stopped by about 1980. And then it stopped for the next 16 years until California passed their medical marijuana in 1996. And since then, one state after another has moved to medical marijuana, where today we have 24 states with full-blown medical marijuana and another 7, I believe, with some form of the CBD, Charlotte's Web, the marijuana, which is good for the Dravet syndrome, which is the seizures in little boys and girls, which in God's medicine is the only thing that is giving relief to those little boys and girls. So people are recognizing, Stuart, that that God didn't make no junk. This is good medicine. And even Florida, even Alabama, even South Carolina passed a small medical marijuana bill. And the upshot of that for me in Congress is 3 Republicans in the House from South Carolina voted with another 48 of them to pass that bill saying the DEA should stay out of the states which have medical marijuana.
Well, whenever I think of South Carolina, I think of a bunch of hippie potheads.
Yeah, I've been there. I finished riding my bike across America last year, and I was in South Carolina, spent a couple days, and yeah, there's all kinds of long-haired hippies running around. It's just like San Francisco part two.
I know. I think when you start winning over people in South Carolina, you can say that you have breached the conservative opposition. Okay, so then the recreational use, of course, is in some sense even more shocking. I mean, even though I understand, most people understand that lots of people are use the medical marijuana legalization as an excuse, it's still nonetheless shocking that a number of states have now openly legalized the recreational use. Where does that stand now? Was Colorado the first, if I recall?
Well, in the election of 2012, and by the way, Misty and I went out there for a month to work the street corners to help pass that. On election day 2012, both Colorado and the state of Washington, their initiatives passed by about 55-56%, a fairly robust win. And those were certified. And so now, since December of 2012, both states have had it legal for 1 ounce or less for adults 21 and over. Colorado worked quickly, and they were able to open up retail stores for the sale of marijuana on January 1st, 2014. And Washington just opened them up about a month and a half ago, around the middle of July. So now both states have storefronts that sell marijuana roughly along the same lines as they sell alcohol.
Did you go out for the grand openings of any of these stores?
No, the temptation was there, but my work here, plus I hate leaving my wife unless it's a real good reason, so I stayed here and watched it on TV. But notice when we watched it on TV, and many people did, by the way, taking a cue from our history, this was a shot heard around the world. Not Lexington and Concord, but the entire world was focused on Colorado on January 1st, 2014, to see if the world would come to an end if people started buying marijuana out of a store and paying taxes. And what is striking, if you go back and look at that, they had long lines, and what you did not see in those long lines was what? 14-year-olds and 16-year-olds. They were all 21 and over. That's the huge change. We are in the process of normalizing the sale of marijuana along the same lines as beer, alcohol, and the problems out there have been absolutely minimal. As I like to say, Stuart, there's been a thundering silence out of Colorado in terms of problems.
It is remarkable. I've had you here for a while, so let's finish off with this. What's next? What's going to be the next state to fall, the next domino?
Well, this fall, we have three areas that have roughly the same ballot language as Colorado. That's now the model for the rest of the country. Oregon will vote on it. They will pass it for sure. Alaska is going to vote on it. That one is running 50-50, so it's very much in doubt. And then the District of Columbia has a legalization initiative. It will pass. The other important state to look at is Florida. They are trying to pass a robust medical marijuana, but they need a 60% margin to have it become law because they're going to change the Constitution. But the polls are running well. We're looking at 67% right now in Florida, so looking good. I personally am going down there in late October for a week. I speak fluent Spanish, so I'll be hitting a lot of Spanish-speaking venues, including media, to help bring home that portion of the vote in the Miami area especially. So that's what's coming up. And then in 16, by the way, you'll see at least four or five states, Maine, Massachusetts, Nevada, California, will have ballot questions to go Colorado, is the way how we put it.
Well, I told you that I was going to ask just about these states, but I do have one more question. I understand there's also a push on the federal level to make it easier for states to function in the banking system. I think that's the big one, and possibly also transporting these substances across state lines. Could you comment on any such federal initiatives that are going to ease the difficulties that these states have?
Let me preface it by saying earlier this year, the Congress passed and the Senate president signed a farm bill which allows for the reintroduction of hemp. Three universities planted hemp this year. They're just now harvesting it to do the research on what farmers can do with the hemp, etc. So that's a big milestone. Yes, the House voted robustly to allow the normalization of banking for marijuana operations all across the United States. Of course, it got tossed up in the CR, but there we have the record of the vote. So the House is ready to normalize banking operations. And the bill I worked on and advocated, which would apply the 10th Amendment, never got a hearing because Congressman Goodlatte, the chairman of the Judiciary Committee, is not going to hold a hearing on allowing states to have their own path on marijuana. But I have some confidence that in the next 3 to 4 years, I might be out of a job. The federal government is more and more ready to say, okay, let's throw it back to the states like we did in 1933 with alcohol. As you know, the 21st Amendment did not legalize alcohol in any of the 48 states. It simply allowed, again, the states to choose their own path.
Okay, Howard. Well, in the meantime, as you're getting ready to head down to Miami and to all these other places you're going to be politicking, how can people get in touch with you?
Well, on a personal level,
I mean, you have a Facebook page or a website
or something.
Got a Facebook
page. And then LEAP is LEAP.cc, Charlie. Personally, if I can answer any questions, I have people ask me all the time for information. They're writing a paper or whatever. My email is Howard Wooldridge, WOOLDRIDGE0@gmail.com. Be happy to take the time to talk to you or send materials, which are usually fairly well footnoted on various aspects of drug policy, especially marijuana policy.
Well, Howard Wooldridge of LEAP, and at the third time you've been on our show, thank you so very much for being on here, and please keep us updated as more dominoes fall.
Certainly will, Stuart. Election night, when you hear the screaming, you'll know it's me going, we've won a couple more states.
Thanks, Howard.
You're welcome, sir. Take care.
And that's our show. Thanks so very much both to Rob Mikos and, of course, to Howard Wooldridge, whom I interviewed via Skype. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our distribution engineers are Bob Hoffman and Nick Rosa. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our Madison Minute is by the incomparable Jim Blaylock. Our music is by the Watauga Fife and Drum Corps. My name is Stuart Harris. And remember, you are a part of the American experiment, dude.